Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Head School. This is your head schoolmaster, Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland magazine. Now, in our last head school, having considered the global impact of the Irish Revolution, Devon, America is what we looked at. This head school is going to zoom in on the local, in particular the market town of Nina and the surrounding North Tipperary area during the revolutionary decade. But we will also be setting events in the wider national context. Now, on the panel today, we have Ger Dooley. Ger's job is a program manager in the Michael Smurfit Graduate School of Business in UCD, but his work, his real passion is history. And in particular, I know what they say, never let your job interfere with your work. And in particular, of course, Ger is the author of Nina, 1914 to 21, Years of Crisis. We also have John Flannery, a past president of the Ormond Historical Society. He's also a member of the Tipperary in the Decade of Revolution Group and the Tipperary GAA Bloody Sunday Commemorations Committee. And incidentally, we've two head schools in the pipeline on that topic. We'll be doing one in the GAA Museum on the 18th of November, but we will also be doing a separate head school looking at the Tipperary connection. You know, the Tipperary connection with Bloody Sunday. So I may be in touch with you about that, John, shortly. And we also have Sean Hogan, also a member of the Tipperary in the Decade of Revolution Group. And he is the author of The Black and Tans in North Tipperary, Policing, Revolution and War, 1913 to 1922. And that is widely regarded as the definitive account of events in North Tipperary, until this morning's discussion, of course. And finally, we have Caitlin White, who's doing a PhD in Trinity College, investigating how public history was used to promote various identities in the two Irish states after partition. And this podcast is supported by Tipperary County Council and the Heritage Council as part of Nina 800. So just to get us started, Caitlin, tell us a little bit about Nina, just a general sort of background. Indeed, you might tell us, what is Nina 800? What's the significance of that 800?
So this year actually marks 800 years since the building of the castle that the town surrounds. So Nina 800 was established to promote a whole manner of events and projects that would celebrate 800 years of the town's development. So before we even get into this period of the Decade of Revolutionaries, Nina Town already had a long established presence here in North Tipperary. And the population of Nina, kind of around this point, it had dropped, as with other parts of the country, significantly since the mid-1800s. After the famine. So the population of Nina dropped by about 45% from the mid-1800s, just kind of at to the start of this decade of revolutionary. So in the 1911 census, the population was 4,776 people living in the town.
How does that compare with the rest of the, where is it rank in size in Tipperary?
Well, the population of Tipperary overall dropped by 65%. So it went down hugely. It went from about 435,000 to about 153,000, which is a massive drop. So Nina actually didn't fare too bad in terms of a loss of population, probably because people were maybe migrating into the bigger towns. It was definitely one of the bigger towns in North Tipperary. Just before the famine, it had actually been named the county town. So in 1838, it was the county town of North Tipperary when the county was divided in two.
Right, of course, and Tip is the only county. It's so good you divided it in two. And of course, only recently, just as a side, recently, of course, it's a single constituency now. Apparently that provoked war down there, but let's not go there. That's a subject for another high school.
Yeah.
Now, Caitlin, in terms of economic activity, I mean, what sort of things are happening in Nina?
So economically, the town recovered quite well from the population drop and the famine, and it was engaged in a lot of industry that serviced kind of the agricultural hinterland that's all around Nina. So Nina serviced all the industry that was going on around, and of course, we have silver mines here not far from the town as well. So there was lots of industry engaging in things like brewing and ironworks. But the main industry, or the main thing that the town even would have been known for, was as a market town. So even the name in Irish, An Taonach, it's the fair, the Fair of Ormond was its full title. So it was quite, by the 19th century, it was quite prosperous. It was expanding and it was doing quite well economically.
Now, I know that Daniel O'Connell had one of his monster meetings in the locality. Is that true?
Indeed. Yeah, yeah, he did. He had a monster meeting in a place called Grange, which is just on the outskirts of the town. So it was quite the event by all accounts in the newspapers.
So would it be true to say that Nina is typical of what I might call Munster nationalism? I say this with some trepidation because it seems that Munster like dominates the Catholic Church, the GAA, you know, that it was the template for sort of, nationalism generally throughout the country. Would it be typical of that?
I'm not sure if it would be quite typical of hotbed nationalism. Like when we're talking about this period, Nina and, you know, one of the other speakers might have a comment on this as well, but Nina was very much, it was a law-abiding town. It was one of the garrison towns as well. And it was a huge supporter of constitutional nationalism.
Just before I move on to Ger on that point, just going back to the economic activity, would it be true to say then there is a substantial proletarian element, you know, working class element, as well as apart from agriculture?
Yeah, absolutely. There was, even you can see, you know, through the records of the Urban Council, there is a huge working class element in the town. And kind of during this decade of revolutions, especially towards the end, there was a huge problem with unemployment as well.
Okay, tell you what, Gerard, can I bring you in here then? Just give us a snapshot of the political situation, say, before 1914.
Yeah, so thanks, Tommy, for having me. So really, as Caitlin inferred there, you know, there was only one party in town, there was only one game in town in Nina, and that was really the constitutional element of Irish politics and the Irish Parliamentary Party. It had, when the Tipperary constituency for Westminster was divided up, the first MP for North Tipperary, P.G. O'Brien, in 1885, he was Irish Parliamentary Party. He retained his seat for years and years and years and never held on to it until 1914, you know, the Irish Parliamentary Party, the incumbent MP at that point was John Joseph Esmond. And, you know, they were riding a wave nationally, the Irish Parliamentary Party, as 1913 turned into 1914. Of course, we all know from junior cert history the reasons why. The Parliament Act had been passed in Westminster, removing the House of Lords' veto upon the progression of the Home Rule Bill through Westminster. Obviously, Herbert Asquith's Liberal government was leaning upon them to pass budgets. And of course, John Redmond, who was leader of the party at the time, the price that he put upon that support was the progression of said Home Rule Bill through it. So when 1914 came, you know, New Year's Day 1914, the people of Nina knew that, wow, this was going to be the year that finally Home Rule was actually going to become a reality. So there was a lot of excitement in the town on the dawn of 1914. That was really shown by an event in 1914. You had John Joseph Esmond, who, you know, he was living in London for the main part in Westminster. It was a parliamentary recess. He came home. Major party in the streets of Nina. Bearing in mind, this kind of stuff wouldn't have been as unusual as from a 2020 perspective, but he was greeted with, you know, marching bands, the Nina Brass Band, torchlit procession. Thousands of people were there to greet him, to listen to what he had to say. And a choir of school children sang a song written by his wife called The Sun Is Now Rising in Ireland. So this is the kind of idea. This is the outlook Nina had come before everything, of course, changed in the months thereafter.
Ger, I'm assuming, what about the volunteer movement, right? How strong was that in the North Tip area?
Well, so, you know, the Irish volunteer movement would have started in November 1913, and the conditions were, as I just said there, the outlook conditions were ripe for a very prominent volunteer movement in Nina. So there was almost a sense of excitement in the town once volunteer corps started to be established in towns nearby, such as, you know, you had corps set up in Tullamore, Abbey Leaks and Mount Mellick just north of it in the Leash Offaly vicinity. And then in Turles and Cashel, you had corps set up as well. So it wasn't until April that a corps was established within within MENA. It was set up by a gentleman called Bertie Gill. And Bertie Gill, you know, his idea for the volunteers within MENA was to feed into the national idea, the progression of the movement as one that could, you know, defend Ireland against all comers and defend the progression of home rule. So it was, you know, and that fed into a real summer of hysteria within MENA with the volunteer movement, which wasn't unusual at all for the rest of the country. The volunteer movement really accelerated. Events like the Corrib Mutiny brought hundreds and thousands of people into the volunteer movement. And then events such as, you know, on the 25th of May, that was the day that the Home Rule Bill was passed through the House of Commons. Within MENA itself, the offices of the MENA Garrison received a special telegram from Dublin, receiving word that the Home Rule had passed through. And there's, again, great excitement on the streets, just as there was in January when Esmond was in town. You had parades, the volunteer movement marched in their hundreds. You had a town crier come out onto the streets, almost a medieval kind of sense. People were singing the nation once again. And then again, a few weeks later, on the 12th of July, it was selected very specifically the date. 3,000 volunteers from all over North Tipperary, and came as far away from Lura and Ross Grey. They would have all come into the town for a major North Tipperary volunteers on fete kind of in the town. And Esmond made a speech in which he said that any man who smuggled a rifle into North Tipperary would be regarded as a friend of his country and a friend of himself. So you can kind of see, perhaps foresee where things were going. But so the volunteer movement, very, very prominent within.
You just touched on something there, actually, which comes up again and again, because in the past, there's always this kind of very strict dividing line between constitution nationalists and physical force nationalists. But listen to what Esmond is saying there. If you listen to the rhetoric of a lot of these Irish Parliamentary Party people, it's not a million miles away from the rhetoric which we'll talk about later during the actual War of Independence, you know, which is worth a comment. Now, that sounds like a very substantial volunteer movement. But of course, events are overtaken by the outbreak of the First World War. So what happens? What are the attitudes to the Great War initially in North Tipperary?
Very supportive initially, Tommy, in the main sense. People, you know, you had the MENA Garda newspaper organizations such as the MENA Urban Council coming out with fairly, untypically kind of unionist tones, saying that, you know, the people of MENA should defend the honour of the empire and all this kind of stuff. The volunteers themselves, to focus on them and the reactions with them, it obviously led to that incarnation of the volunteers kind of collapsed because of the outbreak of the war. When the United Kingdom declared war on Germany on the 4th of August 1914, you had a kind of the collapse of the volunteers due to a paradoxical combination of an eagerness and a reluctance to fight. So some people obviously would have taken up John Redmond's call to go and enlist in the British Army, which he would have made in Wooden Bridge. But then you had other people who were kind of thinking, you know what, I didn't really sign up for this. It was all grand when we were marching through the streets on a lovely sunny Sunday in July in MENA. I don't fancy heading off to France and actually fighting for this. So you had a kind of a dual element there of people out in the hinterland, farmers and farmers' sons who would not have joined. Only 2% of the people in the MENA hinterland that joined were farmers or their sons. So you had this dual kind of people more in the centre of the town who were joining or enlisting in the army in their droves, and then perhaps people in the hinterland and farming background who were not, and lots of reasons for that.
That sounds like what determines your enlistment is class rather than your political outlook. Yeah. That be a fair observation? What way did the National Volunteers, Irish Volunteers, break? You know, the pro-Redmond National Volunteers, any idea of the percentage that broke either way? I mean, it's 10%, 90% nationally. So how is it in North Tipperary?
Exactly. So you kind of have a very similar split. You know, kind of the 10%, 90% that you mentioned there, you have the kind of 14-1 split nationwide, kind of the ratio in terms of the split in the town of MENA itself. You know, you had the meeting, as you would have had in various towns around the country. 29th of September just happened to be the date it happened in MENA. And they discussed Owen McNeill's resolution that the volunteers should not be involved in foreign quarrels. And it was at that, you know, you had only six people opposed it and everybody else voted against Owen McNeill. So that was kind of the split within NINA itself. So reflective of the main national split, that you had very few people, led by the likes of Frank McGrath, remained attached to what would become known as the Irish Volunteers, as opposed to the National Volunteers.
John, did you want to come in on that?
Yeah, Tommy. In the wake of that, the Volunteers pretty much disintegrated. As Jeremy mentioned there, Frank McGrath and Liam Hoolan were basically the main strength of the Irish Volunteers. The rest had gone Redmondite, really, with the National Volunteers. Approximately 70%, 75% of the volunteer movement in NINA supported Redmond. And in the wake of that, and those guys actually leaving and going to France, the Volunteers practically disintegrated in NINA. And it was that way for about 8 months, 9 months before a meeting was convened to actually reinvigorate the Irish Volunteers within the town.
Sean, can I bring you in there? How many First World War veterans later joined the IRA? I'm thinking of Tom Barry in West Cork. Do we have any similarities in Tipperary?
Yes, there was indeed quite a number who joined and who became quite prominent. And they were particularly recruited and used for training purposes initially. But a number of them would have pressed on into the active service units and became, if not column commanders, they became section commanders within that. I'm thinking of Sean Glennon and various others in South Tipperary. You would have had from Hollyford, you had an individual down there. So there would have been quite a significant follow-through from people who came home from the army and who joined.
John, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, the first casualty on the nationalist side in North Tipperary was actually a former British soldier who was a machine gunner in the Royal Irish Regiment, Michael Kennedy. He was killed as a result of the attack on Horsacane Barracks, which was the first barracks attack in North Tipperary. That took place in 1920.
Tell you, just before I move on from the First World War, Kate, like, I'm bringing you in there. Like, are there First World War memorials in NINA?
There are, Tommy. Yeah, there is. There's one. It's a large Celtic cross, and it was unveiled on the 11th November, so Armistice Day in 1928. So a good 10 years after the end of the war. If anyone is familiar with the town, it is a cross from what is now the post office. And it reads just a simple inscription, 1914 to 18, at the going down of the sun and in the morning we will remember them, which was a quote from the popular poem For the Fallen.
So did that cause any trouble at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, by 1928, there was a lot of controversy in general, nationally, around commemorations and monuments relating to the First World War. So in NINA was...
But the point is, it stayed up unmolested, more or less. I mean, it's still there.
Yeah, in common with, quite, say, most towns, NINA also has church memorials. Like, there in the local Church of Ireland, there's a tablet commemorating men from NINA area that, would say, died during the First World War. But unusually, in the Roman Catholic Church, St. Mary's of the Rosary, there's a double window which was erected by one of the local business families, the Kynes, in commemoration of their son who actually died in the First World War. Also, the First World War veterans held parades on an annual basis. Sometimes passed without incidents. Occasionally there would be some jeering and counter-cheering. And those parades continued on an annual basis for, let's say, Remembrance Day, right up until, I suppose, the majority of the volunteers, survivors had passed away in the mid-60s, I suppose.
Now, I want to move on then to, you know, the 1916 Rising. Maybe, Ger, if you could come in on this. You know, the famous WBS poem, All Change Utterly. How utterly was the situation in Tipperary changed by the Rising?
Well, the Easter Rising, it's such a monumental event. You know, Easter Monday, 1916, it was a fair day in NINA. Hundreds of people packed into town. Crucially, you had scores of people who may have lived in Dublin but originally from Nina and would have come back for the Easter weekend. The first sign that something, you know, was awry, there was something wrong, was when they started to get onto the 4 o'clock train to Dublin, and the station master in the train station got a telegram to say under no circumstances was any train to leave Nina. Something was happening in Dublin clearly. And that's kind of indicative of, obviously, communications were effectively cut with the capital. And for the rest of the country, not only Nina, but I've written before about how news came to the likes of Maryborough, Portlaoise, as we know it now. How did they find out about the Easter Rising? And it was a few weeks of kind of trickle-down information, the first editions of the Nina Guardian. You know, they were getting at the essence of what was happening. But, you know, as late as mid-May 1916, you had a Nina urban councillor who was saying, you know, it was the suffragettes that did it. And people were incredulous, were like, what are you talking about? No, the suffragettes were in it. And that's kind of indicative of a level of confusion that was initially there. But obviously that kind of solidified and attitudes started to really change once the picture became clear of what was really happening, especially after, as you inferred, Tommy, after the executions of the leaders of the Rising, attitudes changed in Nina, as they did absolutely everywhere. And that obviously led to the redevelopment, the reinvigoration of the Irish Volunteers, again, as John said earlier, by the likes of Frank McGrath, Liam Hoolan, Ned O'Leary. These were the people that led the post-Easter Rising Irish Volunteers, if you will, into 1917, into 1918, 1919, what would eventually become the IRA. And they would have been, you know, they would have been drilling behind closed doors in fields, kind of in the shadows, until after the death of Thomas Ashe in Dublin. And once Thomas Ashe died, there was an instruction from headquarters to all companies around Ireland that you're not to be drilling in private anymore, come out onto the streets and make yourselves known. So once that happened, things really started to accelerate. They were in the public light. People started
just
to get
interject
arrested.
There, Ger, just one thing. Yeah. Now, obviously, Tip wasn't involved in the Easter Rising, right? So
correct.
I'm correct in saying that when the people who had been interned after 1916 were released, were there any Tip people amongst them? Or what I'm getting at is, did the release of prisoners have a negligible effect on the reorganisation of the Volunteers in North Tipperary?
Well, for kind of North Tipperary specifically, really the nettle was grasped by the people who were actually already in situ and were not involved in the Rising. So the likes of Frank McGrath had no he was a member of the IRB, yes, and he had contact with Cathal Brua and Tom Clark in advance of the Rising, but not necessarily about the plans themselves. So for North Tipperary, at least, it wasn't people who came back from Frongoch that would have been instrumental in doing it. But Sean might have something to add on that.
Yeah, Sean, do you want to come in on that?
Yes, Tommy. I would. I'd contrast between, I suppose, what happened in North and South Tipperary as well. You had the arrest of about 40 people in South Tipperary after two policemen were killed outside Tipperary town in a particular shooting incident. And you had up to 40 South Tipperary people who were interned. And that had a huge impact in South Tipperary. There was only two or three people from North Tipperary arrested and interned. So you didn't have the numbers. But what you did have and what you will see in 1917, 1918, people who had been interned coming to North Tipperary, being regarded as complete heroes because of their involvement, who were involved in setting up Sinn Féin and Volunteers and IRB units right throughout Tipperary.
I tell you, before I get on to the War of Independence, I just want to deal with the 1918 general election. What happened in North Tip and what constituency was it in? Was the election contested, for example, or what? Ger, maybe you can come in on that.
Yeah, so the North Tipperary general election, you know, there wasn't an election because, and it really contrasts with how much Nina had changed in those 4 years. So I mentioned at the start John Esmond coming in January 1914, Churchill processions, etc. He died in 1915. He was serving as a medic during the war. He died in 1915, succeeded by his son, John Limbrick Esmond.
There was a by-election then.
No, this is during the war. So this is in advance of 1918. So the person in situ in 1918 was John Limbrick Esmond. He was only 22 years
old. He was replaced by his son, presumably that it was as a result of a by-election.
Correct. Well, exactly. Yeah, that's the, I'm not sure if there was a by-election, so to speak. Sean,
do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, there was a by-election in April 1915, and he was 22. He was one of the younger members ever elected to House of Commons, his son who was elected into it. He was also in the army, and we can hear more about him if you want.
Yeah, so anyway, so the point is it's a young man position, but there's no election then in 1918, no contested election.
That's correct. So Joseph MacDonagh would have been elected unopposed because John Limerick Esmond, who initially was convinced very reluctantly to run by his colleagues, you know, they had a selection meeting in Nina, but it started an hour late because they couldn't meet a quorum because there simply wasn't enough people turning up to actually have the meeting start on time, indicative of the complete collapse of support for the Irish Parliamentary Party. He was convinced to run, however, a few weeks before the election itself. He should have stuck to his gut instinct because he called out anyway, leading the way clear for the Sinn Féin candidate to be elected unopposed.
Okay, Sean, can I bring you in here now? Because after the release of the prisoners, there was a twin-track approach nationally, the reorganisation of the volunteers, obviously, which we've already touched on, but also then the reorganisation of Sinn Féin, which, of course, bore spectacular results in the 1918 election. How did that kind of twin-track approach work on the ground in North Tipperary?
It was quite spectacular throughout 1917. From 1917, over the course of a 12-month period, you had Sinn Féin clubs formed in every parish, and in parallel with those, you had Irish volunteer companies formed in every parish. The people that have been mentioned, Frank McGrath, Liam Hoolan, people like that, were on their bicycles cycling around from parish to parish, meeting the three or four people who might have been that way inclined, getting them to get organised, to get people together. A lot of women involved in that early stages as well, too, in North Tipperary, in the formation of branches of Cumann na Mban later. But they were involved in that development, the whole Republican movement. And the years 1917 and the by-elections, the Clare by-election and the various other by-elections were all hugely significant events in around Nina. You know, as political events in charting the rise of Sinn Féin, really, and the change, the complete change from the parliamentary party that Jarrah has talked about in 1914 back to Sinn Féin being the dominant party in 1917, 1918.
And what about local government, Sean?
Yes, local government is quite interesting. Jarrah has spoken there how there was no election in North Tipperary or in Mid Tipperary. There were elections in the two South Tipperary constituencies, all right, and there were bitterly contested elections, but Sinn Féin won both. But I think the local elections provide us with a better picture, perhaps, of what the real support for Sinn Féin may well have been. While they swept the boards with their 70-plus TDs or MPs, as it were, the reality on the ground, the first set of local elections were held, and again, these have been deferred throughout the war as well, were urban district council elections, which were held in January 1920. And the first of those show, and it's very interesting, some of the themes that you were picking up there, about the commemoration of soldiers in the Great War, like there were comrades of the Great War candidates stood in Nina and were elected in Nina. So they were a united and organised body. In fact, the site where Kathleen's spoken about, where the monument of the Great War is, there was a kind of a hut structure there where the former comrades from the Great War met and assembled there. It was quite a social gathering, and that was there for many years, I think, as a social event as well. So they were there. You had Labour also. Don't forget that the Transport Union had a growth which was very much in parallel with the growth of Sinn Féin throughout 1917, 1918 in North Tipperary. And again, they had huge numbers of candidates standing in the urban district council election in Nina and would have been very successful. A number might have stood as independents, but it would have been essentially Labour, independent Labour, as they were. So Sinn Féin didn't have it all their own way, particularly in the urban elections. They did then when it moved on to the second phase, which were the rural district council and county council elections in June of 1920.
What was the relations between Labour and Sinn Féin?
From the RIC perspective, the two were synonymous. They were interlinked. So you have people who were members of Sinn Féin, who were members of Labour, who were members of Transport Union particularly, and who were members of, who were volunteers. So the police found it very difficult to distinguish between who was what, and there wasn't a clear delineation. People didn't delineate. They were involved in all branches of as we might call the revolutionary movements that were going on. There was quite a number of trade conflicts. The war was a period of pressure on workers. Prices went up. Prices of commodities went up. Wages didn't go up in keeping with that. So people were under pressure. Inverted commas, the labouring classes were under pressure. And there was quite a number of disputes. And, you know, people becoming members of the unions and whole sectors becoming unionised. It was quite a radical time as well. And you had things like May Day was marked in Tipperary in 1919. You know, there were parades and, things. So quite a radical time, which I think sometimes is forgotten, the extent of the radicalism that was abroad, as it were, at that time.
John, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, there was one notable exception, we'll say, in the ranks of Labour that didn't support Sinn Féin and say refused to leave the way clear for Sinn Féin in elections. That was Dan Morrissey, who later went on to become Minister for Industry and Commerce in the inter-party government. At that stage, Morrissey was a Labour Party candidate in the town, and he refused to stand aside in favour of Sinn Féin, despite, we'll say, Labour been willing to leave the way clear for Sinn Féin, and Morrissey set up his own independent Labour at that period. Yes. He tended to move between Labour, independent Labour, and subsequently Fine Gael in later years.
Gerard, sorry, can I bring you in on something else which crops up in your book, which is called The Year of Crises? Because I was going to ask you, what crisis? just going back to what Sean was saying about the working class is under pressure, just talk to us a bit about that. Because you mentioned petty criminality, the idea that the youth are losing the run of themselves, everything's going to hell in a handcart. Yeah. That's a familiar one, right? But that obviously is part of the background noise here. Just explain what's going on here.
Yeah, so I don't want to linger on that point too much, but definitely when you have, a proportion, you're talking about 40% of the men of military age leaving the town and leaving behind, so many people. There was an element of criminality creeping in, and that anecdotal evidence from the Nina Gargan would certainly support that. But mainly, I think something that is not focused upon enough in Irish historiography is the sheer impact of the weather of 1916 and 1917 and the hardship that brought. My book is called Years of Crises, and it's plural, it's crises, because they had one crisis upon another and another. And the weather, it's mentioned sometimes in the accounts of the by-elections around that time. But, you had a period for 37 days between the 14th of January 1917 and the 19th of February 1917. On only 2 days did the minimum daily temperature exceed above the freezing point. You had minus 17 degrees Celsius was the lowest temperature of the ground. You had the River Shannon freezing over in Drumminier, which, led to very amusing scenes of trying to play hurling and skating and all sorts on the River Shannon. But obviously that led to a great failure in the potato crop. As Sean had inferred, prices were rising a lot. The agricultural index generally rose 60% during the war years. The staple of the diet obviously was still a lot of potatoes that would have trebled in price. Bread and eggs would have doubled in price. So when there was a big shock to the system due to the weather around the winter of 1916-1917, you had St. Vincent de Paul coming in and organising the equivalent of food banks, and as well as a firewood for people of Nina who are really, really struggling.
Sean, you want to come in on that?
Sinn Féin capitalised on that one as well. They were only emerging at the time, but certainly later on the threat of famine was used. We're going to have a repeat of what happened before. Sinn Féin will be the party to organise food and do that. And in fact, they became quite good. And during the Limerick Soviet in April 1919, the North Tipperary Sinn Féin would have been very involved in making sure that food supplies were channelled into Limerick during that few-week period when the Limerick Soviet was in place.
Now, if all that wasn't bad enough, lads, you also have the small matter of the Spanish flu. I don't want to depress listeners. This is a COVID-free zone, but we do have to mention this. I mean, that's there in the background as well, from 1918 onwards. Sure, you want to come in on that?
Yeah, so, perhaps Nina was not as impacted as much as other areas in the vicinity, but I estimate through research that maybe north of 30 people died from the Spanish flu at the time, but the kind of morbidity rate of it, the Nina Gargan was quoting during the second wave, that, you had you had, there wasn't a family within Nina that was unaffected. So that figure of 30 is probably a bit of an understatement. In North Tipperary, generally, you had 143 people who officially died from the Spanish flu. No doubt there was many more, but in that rate alone, in terms of the raw numbers, it would have made the mortality rate in North Tipperary on a par with the likes of Antrim. And when you think about Antrim, obviously had Belfast, which was the first epicentre of the second wave of influenza. Compare that to Tipperary, which was a more rural area, shows the impact of the Spanish flu in North Tipperary and Nina.
And Caitlin, I presume that there's no monuments to those who died from the Spanish flu.
There's not, Tommy, no.
I wonder, will we have any for COVID, right?
it's a big
monument somewhere. Yeah. Sean, you wanted to come in?
I do, for sure, on that particular point, because there was one very prominent flu victim in Tipperary. That was Pierce McCann, who was a Sinn Féin TD South Tipperary. He died in prison in March 1919. And that became a huge event. And I would say it was probably one of the turning points in Sinn Féin support in Tipperary. If you had checked that Salah Ed Begg had taken place in January 1919, and they were roundly condemned and widely condemned, Pierce McCann died in March of 1919. And unfortunately, his funeral wasn't a COVID-type funeral. It was a huge public event as his body was brought back to Dublin. And, you know, the photos, thousands and thousands of people in Dublin at the Pro-Cathedral, Michael Collins and you know, the various other people carrying his body out, the whole procession down to Tipperary when he arrived in Thurles and the train out as far as his home where he was buried, was a huge, huge event with thousands of people attending the funeral. So that when Knocklown happened a few months later, it was a much more muted response and attitude. And I think the death of McCann, in fact, probably was a significant factor in the change of attitudes in Tipperary.
I mean, would there be a general sense, like, if any bad happens, the government is blamed? I mean, it's the same today, basically. Would that be the general attitude that it was the British government who took more flack over the whole flu crisis? Jared, maybe a comment on that?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I think comparing it to perhaps with the lens of a 2020 might not be the right way of looking at it. But I certainly agree with Sean. What happened to Pierce McCann in prison in Britain, the impact that that had was absolutely instrumental in what was to come months later on, absolutely.
And I think the point is, of course, in those days, people were used to these kind of pandemics and you know, we've had almost a century of freedom from this sort of thing. But let's move on from that. Sean, I want to get on to the conflict itself. How did that develop on the ground? Obviously, you're not a million miles away from Salah Beg there. But perhaps has there been too much focus on that? And we did a head school, of course, last year on that, which you participated. But how did the conflict develop on the ground?
Yes, it was quite interesting, I suppose, really. We did have a high degree of commemoration around Salah Ed Begg in January 2019, you know, and as the start of the War of Independence. And, of course, then there was Knocklown, as I mentioned, in May of 1919, when Sean Hogan was rescued from the train in Knocklown. And we tend to associate South Tipperary, I think, much more with the War of Independence, you know, because of Breen's book, and he certainly got his story out there. But the reality, interestingly enough, was that it was in mid and North Tipperary that the early attacks on the police, the RIC, took place thereafter. You had District Inspector Hunt was shot in Thurles on 23rd of June 1919. There was an attack in Lura on 3rd of September 1919, led to the death of Sergeant Philip Brady. There was a Constable Finnegan shot dead in Thurles on 22nd of January 1920, Constable Hinu in the Rag on 3rd of March 1920, and Constables Rock and Healy in Tumivara on 16th of March 1920. And I list those particular attacks because of the 29 people who were killed up to the end of March 1920, which is halfway through the timeline of the War of Independence, you know, 11 of those were RIC men from North Tipperary Division of the RIC. The next member of the RIC who was killed in South Tipperary wasn't killed until May 1920, a full 12 months after Knocklown. So there's a sort of, in the history, I think, people's association with Breen and Tracy and Robinson, you know, has tended to skew things. Whereas the reality was that there was a series of small attacks took place. Local attacks took place in both Mid and North Tipperary at the time. And that was right up to that time. You know, I tend to think of the end of March of 1920 as a kind of tipping point in the conflict. You know, up to that, it was all small local IRA attacks with fairly minimal casualties, I think. But the implications were huge. Like, the British justice system had pretty well collapsed. And that's not just my view, but the view of Lord Justice Ronan, who was presiding over the assizes in Nina in March 1920. And he would have been presented with the white gloves for deriding North of Erie being free of crime, despite the fact there had been a whole series of murders, intimidation, arson and everything else of the early stages of the War of Independence that had taken place. So up to that point, I think Tipperary probably stands out, and North and Mid-Tipperary in particular, as an area where the conflict started and the patterns were set for later. I think after that particular period, North Tipperary and Nina in particular comes much more in line with the pattern of what happened in active counties where the Republicans were active around the country thereafter. Over the summer of 1920, you had the IRA progressed on to their first big operations, the attacks on the barracks. And John Flannery has already mentioned that Michael Kennedy, an ex-soldier, was killed in the attack on Bursacane in June 1920. You had an attack in Rare Cross. You had several other attacks, Hollyford and other parts of the county as well. And then after that, the patterns was really in September, October, 1920. It was then that events really took off as a war. I think up to that, it was a fairly limited local sort of conflict that had been going on. After that, you had IRA men who were increasingly on the run, getting together and using the available military weapons, which were very scarce. I mean, the North Tipperary IRA might have had 20, 25 military specification rifles, and maybe up to 50 rounds of ammunition for each of those rifles. It was mainly shotguns they had. They had very poor arms. So they got together into what were called active service units, what became known as the Flying Columns later. And parallel with that, of course, the Crown Forces were reacting. We had the Auxiliary Division of the RIC coming in on top of what were called the Black and Tans, would be recruited in March 1920, or from March 1920 on. They came in October. You had two companies of them, one in Ballina, as in Ballina Killaloo, and G Company over there, another company in Templemore, staying in occupied Carden's estate house in Templemore. So it was from then on that really the conflict became a lethal and deadly conflict, and very much fitting the pattern of the rest of the country.
Yeah, just in terms of the early stages of it in particular, what strikes me about this is the intimacy of this. I mean, because violence often is intimate. I mean, in the sense that people, they would have known the people they were targeting. I'm thinking of District Inspector Hunt, for example. Yes. I mean, this is a guy who'd lived in the area for years, you know, was well known. Yeah. Any comment on that, either Sean or John? You know, I mean, and even Caitlin, because this is a bearing on how this thing is commemorated. You know?
Yes, Todd, you mentioned the early stages there. It was actually an event in the very early stages, before anything much happened. I mean, Sean mentioned the deaths of the two policemen in 1916 around the Tipperary town area. But one almost forgotten event was in 1918 in Silver Mines, where a man by the name of George Sheehan, he was the father of a British soldier who was home on leave. And there was an arms raid on the house, an attempt to seize the 303 rifles belonging to Sheehan. And it went horribly wrong. And George Sheehan, his father, ended up being shot dead. And the fallout from that was that a number of local men from the Silver Mines were arrested. And there was an attempt to try them in Nina. And a large group of people had gathered outside the courthouse. And Inspector Hunt ordered a baton charge on those people, which left a very sour taste in people's minds in the locality, and actually was a catalyst in, I would say, the death of Hunt. In that there was a dislike for Hunt following that baton charge, and when the decision came to be made in relation should Hunt be shot, because of the progress he was making in relation to the Not Long rescue, the decision was much easier because there was terrible opposition for Hunt. I mean, there's a story which I heard recently, and Sean will be familiar with it as well, where Hunt was actually shot at the day of the races in Thurles.
We had a piece in History Ireland about 6 months ago, right?
A woman that was working in service in a house some distance in the Tumivara area came home from their races that evening and was asked by the family, well, how did the day go? And she said, oh, we had a great day. We shot Hunt and everything.
Yeah, I mean, obviously he was shot in broad daylight, and you know, nobody saw a thing. And judging from the picture of him that we had in the History Ireland article, he's a fairly severe looking character, you know. But Caitlin, how is this? Does this bear on how the conflict was commemorated? Because presumably your victims on both sides from the area.
You do, absolutely. I think what has happened in how it's remembered and how it's commemorated is that, you know, there was one side whose narrative kind of won out. And I think that's really obvious. You know, when you were talking earlier on about the intimacy of the attacks, one of the things that actually stands out when you're kind of, now this is moving forward a little bit, but when you're looking at attacks on the local population during the ceasefire period and in the Civil War, one of the things that comes out is that people knew their attackers. And there was one incident where women were able to identify men who had assaulted them from a local dance that they had all been at. So I think when we're looking at people remembering this period, the War of Independence, the Civil War, the whole revolutionary decade, I think sometimes we forget that when people were remembering, there was actually also a lot of people who wanted to forget, because it must have been a very traumatic time for them.
I'm just thinking of the terms of new sources that have become available, the military services archives. I'm not sure how far up we are at the moment, but I'm assuming some of that's going to be very controversial, because to get your pension, you had to say who shot who and from behind what hedge and exactly what happened. But people will be named and so on. Sean, any comment on that? I mean, are there some ticking time bombs there waiting to go off?
There are indeed, and I think the statements, you know, I think we as historians, we need to be critical of our sources. The fact that someone has said something doesn't necessarily make it so. But I think in terms of developing a narrative, and I think that, I suppose, the work that that we would all have been doing over the years and over for decades in some of our cases has been to sift through the various accounts and to come up with probably, you know, in my book, those 86 killings that I go into in some detail and describe my sources and whatever. I wasn't there. We're never sure entirely what happened, but you can sort of hint at the probabilities of this is the likely development. I think as historians as well, and it's very easy to slip into the one of condemning people on both sides. You know, those early IRA attacks were pretty horrific. I mean, the two constables shot in Tumibara were coming from devotions, were unarmed. The IRA men walked up behind them and shot them several times in the back. You know, it was condemned as a horrific attack, you know, at the time. It wasn't glorious flying columns taken on, you know, in Kilmichael or anything like that. And that was the reality of a lot of the War of Independence. So, as Coughlin says, lots of people were willing or were wanting to forget sort of the things that they were involved in and that happened and whatever. And while there may have been attempts to present things as glorious events, they weren't necessarily and won't be seen by later generations as glorious events. There were things that people got involved in. And I think it behoves us to try and understand why they did the things they did. Why did those groups of young people, young volunteers in Lorra or in Tumivara or in Kilcommon or various other places, do the things that they did? No, the small local groups. Why did they? Because it wasn't at all clear there was a War of Independence. I know Dan Breen later called it a War of Independence, but it wasn't clear that that was going on in those early months when they took out the gun and shot their local policeman. You know, it was as horrific as that. And I think that it is. And likewise then on the corollary, the other side, when the police turned to retaliation, I think rather than simply condemning, and the Black and Tans take the blame for everything. You know, they did all the depredation during the War of Independence. But to understand why the different branches of the Crown Forces retaliated in the way that they did. And it's very easy to understand when you read the accounts, the contemporary accounts of an RIC sergeant who had his two young constables killed, shot in the street out in front, as he wept, as he described, these were like his sons who were living with him in the barrack, you know, with himself and his wife and his own children, as he wept, as he described, you know. So it's easy to understand how those men became involved in retaliation. And I think the important point is it wasn't just the Black and Tans. It was original RIC men. It was Black and Tans, that is RIC recruited after 1st of January 1920. It was Auxiliary Division and it was military. We're all involved in the retaliations. And I think if you look at the circumstances, I'm not excusing the circumstances. I'm saying, but try and understand maybe, Tommy, is what we have to do.
Sure. I mean, my understanding is that the regular RIC, you know, the research suggests that they're just as bad, if not worse, than Aussies or Black and Tans. But listen, Sean, just to finish up on the War of Independence, I just want to just crunch a few numbers for us. Like, in terms of casualties, if you want to look at it as a league table, where does Tipperary, first of all, the county as a whole, where does it stand in terms of the rate of casualties?
The county was divided in two, of course. There was, interestingly enough, the tables would suggest 86 people killed, both north and south. In fact, the figure is higher, Tommy. We've done a lot of work since, and with the national historians as well on this one. So I think the figure is closer to 220, in fact, in the War of Independence in Tipperary. Now, every other county's figures will go up. So we're in there after Cork and Dublin and Belfast or Antrim, as it were. But Tipperary would be ahead of Clare and Kerry and counties like that in terms of the people who were killed. I've done analysis of North Tipperary, and interestingly enough, half the casualties were Crown Forces, and the other half were civilians, either IRA or actual civilians. And it was original RIC men who were mostly killed in North Tipperary. 23 of 36 RIC men killed were, you know, serving prior to 1st of January 1919. So they were the ones who bore the brunt, really, of the war. And they are part of what's forgotten. I know there was a lot of controversy at the beginning of the year, and perhaps there was a mistaken attempt in terms of remembering. But, I mean, they're the ones who did bear the brunt of the casualties in North Tipperary.
Right, and of course, this brings up the question,
Tommy, could I come in there?
Yeah, sorry, John. Well, just before you do, John, we had a head school on the Cork situation, and Cork, of course, is top of the league table.
Yeah.
And I asked the question, you know, is this something we should be ashamed of, or that we should be proud of, right? Because this is, and that's the question in the mind of most people listening to this, I suspect. I just want to get a view on that.
I think it's a tough one, as we saw earlier this year. But I definitely think with the 100 years of space now, give or take, that we have between us and the events that happened, that we should be able to cast a more critical eye on ourselves than we have in the past, and actually analyse and look at the events for what they were, rather than maybe how we feel about them, or how we've been taught to feel about them through history in school or anything like that.
No, but I just think we should bear in mind, though, that the people had voted overwhelmingly for an independent republic in 1918. And now, of course, that's open to interpretation, but they certainly voted for some form of freedom, which they didn't get. I think we shouldn't forget that. John, I want to move on to you, because I'm keeping an eye on the time here, right? And I want to
just in relation,
yeah,
the figures there. Doing some work recently on Bloody Sunday, I just looked at South Tipperary and North Tipperary. South Tipperary is very much up there as being one of the hotspots, but if we look at the figures for North Tipperary from the 1st of January 1920 to the 20th of November, the day before Bloody Sunday, the casualties for both North and South Tipperary were actually 52 people killed in that period. But if you break down...
In 52 in each area?
No, 52 were killed totally in country.
In total, okay.
From the 1st of January to the 20th of November. Now, in North Tipperary, 29 of those casualties took place, with 23 taking place in the south. And the breakdown was 11 IRA men in the north, 3 civilians and 15 members of the Crown Forces, as opposed to 4 IRA men in the south, with 5 civilians and 14 members of RIC, British Army.
Sean, would it be right in saying that suggests to me a pretty effective IRA, leading the morality of out of it for a second?
I think the morality, and as you say, the people were operating from a particular space, and I don't think it's for us necessarily to judge them. I think we can comment, all right, but I wouldn't necessarily judge what they were doing. No, I think what John is saying is correct. The IRA was effective, but it was their assassination campaign that was effective. It was the assassination campaign inflicted the casualties. I mentioned the active service units, and we associate flying columns mostly with the War of Independence because of Kilmichael and various other ambushes like that. But there were 5 successful IRA ambushes by flying columns in Tipperary, which killed about 20 members of the Crown Forces, which is only a small part of what happened. The reality is they were shot in pubs, they were shot coming out of devotions, they were shot going home, they were shot in various places, wherever they could access them. The IRA shot them wherever they could target, and when the local circumstances determined this is what they were going to do, that's what happened.
Yeah, but Sean, could that not be that the reason for that is that this never developed into a full-scale war? You know, and I keep reminding people of this. If you compare Ireland to other small, inverted commas, conflicts that broke out, because, I mean, Europe was a war right up to about 1923, that our war of independence and civil war was very, very small beer compared to what was happening, say, in Finland, Turkey, Greece, Turkey, you know, the various, socialist uprisings, Germany, I think we need to get a grip here. You know, we always need to reflect that this was a relatively low level in terms of violence. This was a political struggle first and foremost.
Absolutely. And I think the key to that was the armament situation. The IRA were very poorly armed. They had little or no weapons. They had very little ammunition. It was a constant struggle. And they were sensible. These were shrewd enough people. I mean, there was two companies of auxiliaries driving around North Tipperary, armed to the teeth with machine guns and every other kind of weapon that they had. The IRA kept out of their way, other than in one or two places where they were surprised. Very sensibly, because they hadn't the weapons to take on those. The IRA didn't have the weapons to take on a sustained firefight in the way that the ex-soldiers who knew what firefights were like and what the kind of ammunition and resources and artillery you needed to dislodge enemy, they didn't have any of that sort of weaponry. And I think we have to bear that one in mind. And that striving for weapons was a constant driver of some of the local events as well, too. So I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it was in real terms relatively low. And I mean, I think we have to look where responsibility lies for the escalations that happened in October, November 1920, with the death of McSweeney and what happened thereafter, turning the auxiliaries loose to take murder by the throat. You have to look where responsibility for that lies for the escalations that happened.
Now, John, I want to move on to you here because I look at the time here and just moving on to the Civil War. Just before we get to the Civil War, I'm just curious, what was the atmosphere of Tipperary, from the truce up until the outbreak of the Civil War? I mean, what did people expect? I'm assuming that as a more active area, like Cork, for example, or Kerry, that expectations would have been much, much higher in those type of areas. Well, John, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, well, what's very much ignored, really, is that in the period of the truce, North Tipperary pretty much descended into total anarchy. There was a lot of land agitation going on. The local big house, the real big house in the Nene area would have been Lord Donnelly's estate at the Silver Mines. That was under almost constant siege during the truce period, with livestock being stolen, trees being cut down, farm implements being stolen. There was a constant, parade of attacks on the man. There was land agitation around the Borsalee area. In February of 1922, there was a man shot at Knockshoroon outside Borsalee in what was a blatant attempt just to get him off, the family off the land. There was other attempts, in Borsalee and Clough Jordan area, where farmhouses were burned out, hay burned, livestock stolen, things like that. And in addition to that, a lot of post office and bank robberies taking place. So the whole area was pretty much descended into lawlessness. And this is borne out in a lot of the reports that were going on between the liaison officers for Tipperary and the RIC, inspectors. The whole situation was, in decline. Added to that, then, you had the return of bodies of men that had been killed in other areas during the War of Independence. Notably, Sean Bergen had been brought back following his killing in Roscommon in 1921. But in April 1922, there was the first anniversary of his death, and that showed up really the split in the ranks that was beginning to take place, in that following a mass in the local church, there were actually two parades to Lisbonnie Cemetery outside Nina, where Bergen was buried, and a memorial was going to be unveiled over his grave. And there was both an anti-treaty parade, which was supported by the family, and following which the memorial was unveiled. But that was immediately followed by a pro-treaty group going to the cemetery to commemorate him also. So straight away, you can see that the dichotomy was there and the battle lines were being drawn pretty much.
Just, John, before I go on the Civil War, Chair, I want to bring you in there, just going back to your point about, you know, petty criminality. I mean, would I be right in saying that because of the war, because of this location, there's a general kind of loosening up of the normal kind of social glue of society, if you like?
Yeah, that certainly would be the case, Tommy, absolutely. Like you would have seen, Sean touched upon land agitation, and so did John, that was happening. You could see that all over the country in areas like, you know, North Kerry. You see it in West Meath. The War of Independence was being used as a kind of a front to mask up kind of generational old issues about land and stuff like that. And once the War of Independence emerged, some of these people had very little association with the IRA, were using them as a front to get even in some cases. And the social glue that was kind of held somewhat together would have been kind of eroded a bit during this time, certainly, absolutely.
Sean, you want to come in on that?
Yes, please, Tommy. I think John has spoken about the descent to anarchy, but I think on the weekend of the 12th of June, 1922, whatever was happening in the area, there was a number of appalling events took place in the Nina area. It was what has become a violence against women is only emerging as a sort of a topic, really, as an issue, which was a fairly horrific case of multiple rape of a woman near Drumminier. And, you know, that became a big case and, there was class issues, I think, involved as well as everything else involved in that particular case. And just to flag that one, that there was multiple dimensions which are going to be difficult for us to remember, I think, in the couple of years ahead.
Now, John, just going back to you now, just remind us, what way did Tipperary, North Tipperary in particular, break on the treaty?
Well, in relation to the treaty, initially there was pretty much wide acceptance of the treaty. I mean, the main figures during the War of Independence in North Tipperary would have been Sean Gaynor, Liam Hoolan, Sean Collison, who was the leader of the Flying Column, and Ned O'Leary and Con Spain. And initially they all supported the treaty, so much so that Gaynor was even appointed OC of the barracks in Kilkenny, where he was visited by Ernie O'Malley on instructions from Andy Cooney, who was an North Tipperary man that was violently opposed to the treaty. Cooney sent down O'Malley to Kilkenny, and on foot of O'Malley's advances to Gaynor, Gaynor actually left Kilkenny barracks and headed to Crinkle, where he actually seized the Crinkle barracks, which was one of the biggest barracks, would say, in Offaly and Tipperary area, from Sean Glennon, his former comrade. And he took over, that was one of the early barrack takeover, would say, in the region, really, where the anti-treaty IRA seized the barrack. And that was actually in April of... Now, it also had the effect that a lot of the big names, like Paddy Ryan Lacken, Gaynor, Cooney, they were all out of their own area, in, let's say, around Nina. And that had a huge impact in allowing the pro-treaty viewpoint to prevail under Liam Hoolan in Nina and Colonel Jerry Ryan in Thurles. And these were men that had great influence within the ranks of the rank and file. And they brought a huge number of the local people, with the local members with them, with the result that North Tipperary became pretty much a pro-treaty stronghold due to the fact that the main protagonists on the anti-treaty side were out of the county at the time.
So they were outsiders, kind of outside agitators, they could be depicted as.
Well, they were outside. Had they been present in North Tipperary at that period, the situation may have transpired differently. The fact that they were absent from the county, I think, had a huge impact.
And that's a pattern we see throughout the country, as I understand it, you know, that you've a lot of people displaced, if you like, individuals. And obviously, if you're away from your home place, I would speculate you would tend to be more radical in your outlook. Sean, can I just come to you? I mean, presumably there was a large number of IRA people who just stayed neutral, who backed neither side in the conflict.
Yes, although it became very difficult to do that for people. A number of people just quit and stayed away from things and tried to stay away. But it was very difficult when things were going on around them and they were coming under pressure from both sides and people seeking support and people on the run coming looking for shelter and, former comrades and people not wanting... people were in very difficult situations, really, and the dilemmas that individuals, at that individual level, that people faced. In this particular area. I mean, I think the pattern again that John describes there, the outbreak of hostilities and how things developed, are probably reflective of the pattern across the country in the Civil War in terms of, and it became much more like a war because both sides were better armed. Is again the point that I would make.
Now, I'm presuming that when the Free State Army retook Limerick, that was. It was all over from the broader military point of view in that neighbourhood. Or am I right? Or am I wrong on that one?
Absolutely, Tommy. Like Michael Brennan, in his summing up of the situation, he said that the whole civil war turned on Limerick. Likewise, Sean McSweeney stated that after Limerick, I personally did not believe that we could obtain a complete military victory, and the Limerick situation was really. Predicted the outcome of the war, and the failure by the anti-treaty side to seize the initiative, which they held, that really determined their fate in the Civil War. Lynch was very reluctant to, would say, go into action against his former comrades, and he did everything he possibly could to avoid it, down to the extent of negotiating a treaty with Brennan and O'Hanigan in Limerick. And would say allowing them to take strong points within Limerick, even though they were more than twice outnumbered in terms of manpower. The treaty that they negotiated locally was repudiated by Dublin, and Brennan was and O'Hanigan were both ordered to have nothing further to do with the anti-treaty side and to basically drive them out of Limerick. And it was in this context that North Tipperary really came into focus, because the anti-treaty side in North Tipperary were ordered at all costs to prevent Limerick being resupplied and to try and take the town of Nina. Nina at the time was on the direct route from Dublin to Limerick.
What time are we talking about here? What month?
You're talking here of, we'll say, early June.
So still early days of the
war. Still early days, yeah. I mean... From early June towards the end of June, you had that stalemate situation transpiring in Limerick, where kind of both sides were anxious to avoid facing off with each other. And at this period, those remaining in Tipperary that were anti-treaty were told at all costs to prevent the resupply of Limerick.
Now, once Limerick is taken, though, John, what happens in North Tip then?
Well, on the 28th of May, they blew up the railway line between Burt Hill and Nina. There was an attempt to stop supplies by rail getting through, but they didn't with Burt Hoolan and Jerry Ryan holding Nina and Turles. They were pretty much on a loser. Hoolan had been responsible for setting up a lot of the safe houses in the North Tipperary area, and he knew all the bolt holes that the anti-treaty side were going to use. Jed O'Dwyer, who was his second in command in Nina, in an interview with Tom Toomey, who wrote the history of the War of Independence in Limerick, O'Dwyer stated that he couldn't believe the strength of Hoolan's intelligence in the North Tipperary area, that he seemed to have a sixth sense in relation to where the men were moving at any given time and what their likely course of action would be. And he was able to outguess them time and time again. Likewise, Jerry Ryan in Turles. Ryan managed to outmaneuver, a brigade of Kerry men that were massing to attack Turles. And he arrested over 90 of them in a roundup in the area just between Turles and Kilkenny.
John, can I just bring you in here? Once the you know, the broader strategic things are taken by the Free State. I mean, you had the amphibious landings in Kerry, Cork, Limerick is taken. What happens in North Tip then for the rest of the Civil War, up to the dumping of arms in 1923?
It's very much a war of attrition. You have the stronghold becomes the Silver Mines Mountains region. The Dente Treaty side retreat into the hills around there and just launch sporadic attacks out there. Like you know, the main road from Nina to Limerick was, and the rail line were constantly being hit. Your ambushes, we'll say, on Free State convoys at Bushfield on the 26th of August in 22, at Boher just a couple of hundred yards down the road, 17th of September 1922. And in these, like, you had significant enough casualties. At Bushfield, you had three Free State killed and three injured. At Boher, a column of Free State on the way to mass on a Sunday morning were ambushed. And again, three were killed and one wounded, with one anti-treaty casualty, just a young lad of 16 years of age being killed. You also had an engagement at Crumlin, just outside Moneygall, where, again, acting on intelligence, the Free State surrounded a house where a group of anti-treaty men were hanging out. That ended up with the anti-treaty group actually breaking out of the house and killing two Free State soldiers in their escape. But it is very much a war of attrition. They're pinned into the hills, constantly under attack from three directions, from Limerick, Thurles, and Nina. And they're pretty much ineffective. I mean, they managed to make these, we'll say, forays on the railway line and on the road, inflicting casualties, but nothing decisive, which is going to... there was an attempt to take Nina on the 29th, 30th of June, but by the 3rd of July, that had been beaten. They'd been driven out of the town. Again, in August, they made an attempt to take one of the barracks, and again... that went badly wrong when a mine prematurely detonated and killed Jimmy Nolan, who was actually the leader of the attack. And that resulted in that was followed up with the burning of the workhouse in Nina, which drew huge opprobrium from, we'll say, the clergy and people of influence in Nina, because it left a lot of people that were depending on the workhouse at the time destitute, and it also removed the facility of the hospital. The workhouse was used as a hospital in Nina, and the town lost its hospital and workhouse because of that burning. And this had an effect of turning people very much against the anti-treaty side in the locality.
Now, John, I'm just taking a look at the time here, right? I just want to move on to the question, you know, after the Civil War, and maybe Caitlin can come into this as well. How did the opposing former combatants in North Tip, how did they deal with each other, you know, the aftermath of the Civil War? I mean, they had to live their lives.
Strangely enough, there was, an amazing degree of wanting to let things be forgotten and get on with life after it. And this was shown very much in relation to, would say, when the pensions, particularly in 19, would say, when the Pensions Act was changed in the 1930s following the election of the De Valera government. At that stage, you had Austin McCurtain's brother, Sean McCurtain. He was back in Nina practicing as a solicitor. Now, he'd been jailed in Peterhead for activities in Northern Ireland just before the outbreak of the Civil War, and had spent 8 years in jail in England and Scotland. And he'd returned to Nina, set up practice as a solicitor. And the McCurtain family were pro-treaty. Austin McCurtain, after Michael Collins, was the highest ranking Free State officer killed during the Civil War. He'd been killed at Town Duff in Leash. And McCurtain acted on behalf of an awful lot of the pro-treaty side, people like Paddy MacDonald, Sean Gaynor, Sonny O'Neill, in their attempts to get pensions. And likewise, when McCurtain himself was trying to secure his own pension, testimony to what his own involvement and the involvement of the family generally in the War of Independence was given by Sean Gaynor. So you see that there was that kind of rapprochement between them. Likewise, at a lot of meetings held in the town at the time, you can see cooperation between the two sides. But what really became, I suppose, the big healer was during the emergency. Both sides joined the LDF or FCA, and people like Sonny O'Neill and Sean Gaynor both held officerships in the FCA. And despite being on the anti-treaty side during the Civil War, I mean, they worked very closely with the army men, would say in headquarters, people like Liam Hoolan, who at that stage was a general in the army. Gaynor and O'Neill were able to work quite easily with the likes of Hoolan at that period. And I would say the period of the emergency was a huge healer in that all comrades got back together, served under in the same uniform, under the same flag, and for the same ideal. And I think it had a huge healing capacity at the time. Likewise, the GA. The GA was a neutral meeting ground where a lot of those people could meet. Frank McGrath was very prominent in the GA in North Tipperary all during this period. And again, would say the GA had pretty much a healing effect. So much so that, we'll say, up in the 1970s, when a lot of these men were, a lot had gone to the grave, and this surviving group actually came together and formed a committee to erect a memorial to Michael Kennedy that we'd mentioned earlier, the first casualty in a barracks attack in North Tipperary. There was no memorial up to then on his grave. And in 1970, a committee was formed under Michael Gaynor, the brother of Sean Gaynor, to erect the memorial. And on the day the memorial was erected, the oration was given by M.J. Costlow, who served in the Free State Army. And other people like Con Spain were very prominent, would say, in the memorial committee. And pictures from the unveiling of that memorial show the IRA parading in to the cemetery in Kilbarran on the day. And you can see former opponents, would say, of each other in the Civil War, standing side by side, marching in there in unity to remember their fallen comrade. And again, Tom Toomey tells the story that he brought Jeddah Dwyer to one of the big battle sites of the Civil War outside near Tullymylan, near Silver Mines, shortly before O'Dwyer's death. And he met one of the O'Briens from Silver Mines. And the last time the two men had seen each other was when O'Dwyer had taken O'Brien to Nina from Tullymylan as a prisoner following a day-long shootout, which resulted in the death of Joe Mangan and the wounding of another man. But the two of them sat down that day in the Silver Mines and consumed a bottle of whiskey between them as they reminisced about the day and argued over what weapons had actually been in use by the various sides.
John, I was sort of bringing Caitlin in there. My question to Caitlin was, how should we commemorate the Civil War? And you've just given a good way to commemorate the Civil War there, is for comments to sit around and reminisce over a bottle of whiskey. But seriously, Caitlin, how do you think we should approach this? Is this going to be a tricky one a year or two down the line? Any views on that?
It's definitely a tricky one. I think how we've approached the commemoration so far has been quite good in given the power to local authorities to hold appropriate events in their own areas, I think is key. And I think as historians, we probably have a responsibility to provide the information on all aspects, like I was saying earlier, to cast that critical eye. But we have to be really careful, you know, of crossing the line between remembering and honouring. Which I think it's a really tricky one to see. What I would personally maybe like to see is more events that contextualise and interpret the events of the past rather than, putting up a statue saying this is it and kind of leaving it there. I'd like to see more more involving more of the public and more contextualization.
Yeah, and as we've seen other parts of the world, just because you put a statue up doesn't mean somebody will come along at a later stage and tear it down. Sean, you want to comment on that?
Do, Tommy. I suppose really myself and John and with our colleague John Connors and various others were involved in a group called Tipperary in the Decade of Revolution. And we staged, in the same week the controversy took place about the Dublin Castle events for the RIC, we marked events in Thurles that week. And we had a well-attended event with maybe 120 people or so turned up to remember an event which was the shooting of a constable there. And we included other events that had happened around there. But what we had done, we had written the narrative, a booklet about it now. And at the opening of that, we said, look, here's our take on the history of this event. And there are people here who will have different perspectives on this. There was policemen's family there. There was IRA men's family who were involved in shooting them there. People may have different perspectives on this, but you have to, to participate in this event, you have to respect that there are other perspectives here around, and we can all go. And we walked around the town of Thurles, we looked at the locations where these things happened. We had interventions and people telling, adding to the story as it went on. And we came back to the source by the River Shore, and people threw flowers into the river to remember whoever it was that they were remembering. And in that way, we had a huge event, which marked, I think, for the families involved, and sensitively, and done in accordance with, as it were, the guidance. And I think I would put that forward as an example of the kind of events that can be staged. I think as historians, we have to tell the story. We can't either. And there are many examples of people who have been forgotten in history and people who want to be forgotten. People who were shot by neighbours, nothing said to do with politics or whatever, more to do with land and things like that. You know, every name deserves to be remembered who was killed in this period, I would say. And we need to try sort of ensure we can do that and stage sort of events that I've done. Unfortunately, COVID has completely destroyed our program for the year of 2020. And so we hope we'll be back by the time of the Civil War. But I think the same approach would apply to Civil War, because what happened in Thurles was a kind of Civil War. I mean, the people killed were all Irish. The RIC men were all Irish. You know, so you could count that in one way as a Civil War between one perspective of Irishness and another perspective of Irishness. So I think it's not that big a jump from War of Independence into Civil War.
Okay, Sean, I'm going to leave the last word with you on that. So I'd just like to thank the panel, Ger Dooley, John Fannery, Sean Hogan, and Caitlin White. And just to say that our next Head School, which will be posted on Thursday the 24th of September, is entitled, quote, "Better a State Without Public Records Than Public Records Without a State." And that, of course, is the famous quote, rather cynical quote, if you like, from Winston Churchill when he heard about the destruction of the State Paper Office in the Four Courts in June 1922. But we won't be looking at that in particular. What we're going to look at is state formation, archives, and commemoration. And of course, as I mentioned at the outset, we will be doing two Head Schools on Bloody Sunday. One will be in the GAA Museum on the 18th of November. That's projected to be a live event, our first since March. But we will also be doing one looking at Bloody Sunday, the Tipperary connection. And just to reassure Sean that even with COVID, the History Ireland Head School continues and many other activities continue online. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed our discussion here, and I hope to talk to you again. Thank you.